Trying to think, what episode were you thinking there was a quote from that I wanted to do?
A Much Darker Place is the way I wrote it down. It's not one that you would do. It's just one that I was like, oh, you know, that's like totally us.
Oh, I don't know what it is.
Wrote down when Matt Stryker says, well, even salt looks like sugar.
Oh, my God, dude, I wrote that down.
And then I just wrote down, I was like, and if he says it, I'm going to go, you look like sugar.
Dude. Wow, we really are best friends. I was thinking about opening with that quote, except for it's not a good opening quote.
It's not.
And I was hoping that that would be your response. My God, man. It's creepy.
We're in sync. And welcome, believers. This is Lucha Lowdown. I am your host and El Jefe of this podcast, James Kincaid. With me tonight, as always, El Guapo Jeff Budd.
You're a delight, James. I just want to say that.
Well, even salt looks like sugar, Jeff.
I'm sorry, I didn't remember the other part.
You're supposed to say you look like sugar to me.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Maybe you should bring back the quote bit. You do it well.
Yeah, maybe I will. Welcome back to Lucha Lowdown, your one-stop shop podcast for all things Lucha Underground. We're starting tonight with a little bit of news, a follow-up as we've been talking about Lucha Underground's impending arrival to Netflix. So when it was originally rumored to be hitting in the middle of February, clearly that has not happened. It has been given an official Netflix release date for seasons 1 and 2. It is hitting Netflix on March 15th. So very exciting. Some of my wrestling fans friends have been texting me that they actually, you know, they have not been watching Lucha Underground because they feel so behind. But now with it coming to Netflix, they're going to give it a shot. So I think that's just so huge again for Lucha Underground and the fan base that they can reach. I'm very excited for that. So good on Lucha Underground, and we should all be rejoicing because there's going to be a lot more believers, I feel like, because of that.
Yeah, this is a huge deal.
Yeah, it's tremendous.
A big step forward for them, yeah.
And hopefully they keep doing more of the like En Vivo shows that we got to go to. I was looking at the pass they gave us actually as I was cleaning around my room the other day, and it just that was so much fun. So I would love to do that again. But Lucha Underground also threw a little bit of a curveball at us programming wise this week. Originally, the greatest hits offerings for this week were supposed to be A Much Darker Place and Death Comes in Threes. As we announced on our last episode, but they made a little change up at the last second. They made it a 4-episode marathon of greatest hits from season 2 to start off, which is awesome because they were all 4 great episodes. But tonight, so we're gonna have to be going through A Much Darker Place, and we're gonna go in the order of when they aired. A Much Darker Place, The Hunt Is On, Cerro Miedo, and Death Comes in Threes. So let's start with A Much Darker Place, which was the season 2 premiere of Lucha Underground. And this is one when it was announced that they were going to be doing that on the greatest hits. I was looking forward to because I love the opening vignette of season 2 with Vampiro in the loony bin or the nut house, or, you know, I think that's the PC way of talking about it. It's one of my favorite vignettes in the history of Lucha Underground. But what did you think about it?
I think it was a fun way to start season 1. God, dude, I'm sorry. I'm really out of it right now. I think it was a great way to start season 2. I really like Vampiro. I thought it was kind of a fun way to keep that story going as far as his relationship with Pentagon. And I'm also just wondering, it was like, is this how the entire series could end? Is maybe the whole thing was just in Vampiro's head to begin with, and none of these other people even exist?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be that outside the realm of possibilities, because there was definitely some weird stuff going on, like with Matt Stryker having his car like covered up in the desert waiting to pick him up. I don't know. I agree with you, though. It was a great way to start season 2, and it was a great way to logically sort of recap some aspects of season 1. Like, I liked him sitting there as the psychiatrist was sort of reading off, you know, like, are you still having any violent thoughts? And it would just cut back to the Cerro Miedo match with him, like, using the light tube on Pentagon and everything like that. And I thought that was a great way of sort of using elements of a flashback there. And also just the I think the sort of the coup de grace dialogue is there's just one other thing. I need you to avoid the people and places that like put you in this place. They make you have violent thoughts and feelings. And I thought that was so perfect. It's like, well, he's going back to the fucking temple, dude. It's not.
Well, because it reminds you of your favorite movie, Oculus.
Yes, I do. I do love Oculus. That's great knowledge. It's great and a great horror film, and it was fun to talk about.
It's a little James Kincaid lore for the listeners.
That is, and by the way, in these episodes, we get a lot of lore, which is some of my favorite part. And it is fun.
So many vignettes.
Revisit, yeah, there's some very vignette heavy episodes in this. But yeah, avoid the people and places. That was my favorite part of it. But I think more than anything, I think this sort of video package for the opening of season two was a great way to start, because I think it shows what sets Lucha Underground apart from other wrestling promotions are the video package like this, the storytelling that they do with it. It really helps differentiate it. I enjoyed that very much. And just watching Vampiro go nuts in his mind on everyone, it was a great way to start a much darker place. And then, yeah, again, him meeting up with Stryker outside and getting in the car, and Stryker even just saying that we've been invited to go back, but it's a much darker place, setting the tone for season two. I thought it was pitch perfect. Just really great. In watching, though, I will say this. When they prescribed him the pills and everything, it seemed like they were sort of trying to explain away his involvement with Pentagon. I remember when I was watching season two live, just sort of not knowing and being, you know, wanting more of Vampiro and Pentagon together. I could have done with more throughout season two of them playing up the fact that he was taking his meds, or maybe intermittently, like, you know, sort of walking that line with it, sort of to keep explaining away why he wasn't more united with Pentagon. But we got a payoff.
But he threw his pills away.
Yeah, he did. But we got a payoff to that anyway in the season. So, but yeah, I thought that might be the best open ever in the history of Lucha Underground. And also, like, when they go back to the temple after that, I mean, we have Katrina, who is the head bitch in charge now, which is great, and her saying Mill will be watching, and the throne and everything. What did you think when you first saw that with Mil Muertes ever watchful in the temple?
Shao Kahn. Yeah. There's no other way to describe it. He looks like Shao Kahn in those particular stages in Mortal Kombat, where he's either sitting on his throne with the large group of people, or even the more intimate and I think creepy, like Shao Kahn's throne room, where yeah, you're just fighting in front of him. What I like, and I think I noted it a couple times while watching these episodes, is not even when they pan to Mil Muertes, when you just see him in the background, depending on the camera angle during a match, that he's always there watching, which is just so great.
Yeah, and just very, very cool character element for him, and he sold it very well, too. Like, he reacts to things during the matches and everything, which I very much so appreciate. And we start off with a Gift of the Gods title match. It is King Cuerno versus Phoenix, and that, you know, basically, so, I mean, it was set up previously that, you know, Phoenix showed up, right? We did a vignette in Katrina's office?
Yes.
Yeah. And basically wanted Mil Muertes, but, you know, you have to give, like Dario said in season one, you can't just cash it in. You have to give the promoter notice so you can promote the match. And Katrina made him put it on the line. So we do start off with a Gift of the Gods title match, King Cuerno versus Phoenix. And again, playing on the fact that King Cuerno followed Phoenix out of the temple when season one closed. Your thoughts on just all of this going on, the match and everything?
Well, I like this one because there were, like, subtle hints to this rivalry at the end of season one. Yeah, definitely in the ending vignette where you see him following. But King Cuerno was, like, a hair's width away from winning the Gift of the Gods himself. I forget exactly how the match went down, but he was close to winning. Then Phoenix kind of came out of nowhere and sort of swooped in and took it. So, I mean, I can understand why Cuerno has his sights set on Phoenix at this point. What I like about King Cuerno is he really is just on his own. Yeah. You know, I don't consider him a face or a heel. I mean, I guess he's a heel, but he's different. He's not aligned with anybody. Yeah. And he really is that mercenary. Like, you refer to him as Boba Fett a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great spot for him to be. And I think he has the right look and skill set for that type of character, too.
He really is one of my favorite performers in Lucha Underground, which is why I'm sad that he hasn't been in season three. I mean, again, I have to temper that with the fact that they're really selling that death match. And I don't know if King Cuerno, I don't know when he'll be back, but it's...
We just know that we saw him live.
Yeah, exactly.
The performer and the character is still alive. It's just
not
on TV.
He's not been back. So it's fun going back to watch these and seeing him do his thing. And season two was, I feel like, was a real, you know, he started to get his shine in season two a little bit, and could have even more. But yeah, I do like, again, Mill looking on in the first match. And just, I mean, Cuerno and Phoenix have really great chemistry with one another.
I was thinking, yeah, it was a brief feud, but it was a really solid one with really good matches.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't mind seeing the two of them, you know, revisit that at some point.
And like, so far, this is the season two premiere. So they started things off with an amazing vignette to set the tone, get you right back into the place you were at in season one. And then, you know, they kick it off, you know, season one kicked off with Chavo Guerrero versus Blue Demon Jr. This season kicks off with a Gift of the God title match, King Cuerno versus Phoenix. And I mean, and what a match to kick off season two with. It's two of the best performers Lucha Underground has, one of their top baby faces and one of their most cool heels. And they just have a kick-ass match for the title. And I mean, it was great back and forth stuff. I mean, the counter into the thrill of the hunt. That didn't even finish the match, but was just a great moment. And then the hooking tombstone that ended it was super vicious. And we got a title change right in the first match. I thought it was the pace was so intense in this opening episode of Lucha Underground Season 2. So I really enjoyed that quite a bit. It's a great match. It was very enjoyable going back to rewatch that, because I don't think I'd watched it again since it aired live. So that was fun. We got Team Havoc in a vignette, and this is one that stuck with me that I couldn't remember which episode it was. I knew it was early on. I didn't remember if it was in the opener, but this is one that always stuck out to me because it is another laying the groundwork of the feud with Ivelisse and Katrina, because Son of Havoc and Helico and Ivelisse were in the back, and they were basically demanding a title rematch, and we got Evie. Basically, Katrina saying no, but the Mil Muertes does want to watch you guys fight, but fight each other for the right to face him for the title, which, one, is awesome. And two, I liked my favorite part of the whole vignette is Ivelisse walking away and then stopping to threaten Katrina. And, you know, basically saying that she's not going to forget about you, bitch. And just, it was that always stuck out to me. It's just very memorable. What did you think?
I like it. It's a slow burn between those two. And I think we see it. And another one of the episodes too, where the vignette, or it was a different vignette with the two of them sort of trading barbed words with one another. And yeah, we haven't gotten the payoff for that yet. I like it because some of the feuds are very short and to the point, and then other ones really are ongoing and even season spanning. So it's just, yeah, I like it. I'm looking forward to it. I like the three of them together so much.
Yeah.
And I kind of like the idea of Ivelisse being the leader just because of her personality and how she speaks. Where Angelico's more laid back, and Son of Havoc, you know, is always kind of...
He blows with the wind.
Yeah.
He does. He's son of the open road.
So, I mean, I think they fit really well together, and they had great chemistry. And I liked how this season started. I thought this was a really good episode, because it set up a lot of the key points as far as storylines that involved Mil Muertes and the rest of basically Katrina's minions, and I really like that. I also like the idea of the three of them being like main protagonists.
Yeah, I know, I agree. And you mentioned something about how Ivelisse speaks. Her vocal delivery to me, I love it. Like how she delivers her promos and her sort of charged lines to other characters. It feels so authentic to me, and she just has such personality in them. That I don't know. There's just something captivating about Ivelisse and how her whole character and persona, that whole Spitfire thing about her, that I really enjoy. That, you know, she's just so full of that, like, that fight. She's got that lucha in her, you know.
Yeah, and that's why I think she's a good spokesperson for that team. Also, you can't help but look at Ivelisse and think spunky underdog, you know, because of her size, her build, and her gender in the sport that she's in. And their team is always the underdog, despite the chemistry they have and their skill set. They're usually smaller than the other team. At first, they were the ones that, you know, didn't have any chemistry. And it just always seems like the deck is stacked against them. So I like the idea that Ivelisse is the one who's usually got the mic in her hands or, you know, is booking the match for them.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that did set up, it was a three-way match between Team Havoc, so Son of Havoc and Helico and Ivelisse, all facing one another for the right to then face Mil Muertes later in the night. So that is what we got next. We got Katrina seductively whispering to Melissa about what the setup was going to be in the match. And that was delightful.
Love it.
Yeah, that was great. I've written down here, sweet Lord Evie, in terms of her approach to the ring. She was looking great. and then from there, we got a cut to the back of Katrina and King Cuerno. Basically, you know, that they had an agreement going on that, you know, Cuerno's just going to sort of sit on the Gift of the Gods championship and that, you know, Mil Muertes doesn't have anything to worry about. What did you think about that?
Yeah, I liked it. I think that's how it would be. What I also liked is it's the sort of thing that you have to check in with Cuerno, and depending on how long he had the title, eventually he was going to set his sights on Mil Muertes. He can't help himself. He's a hunter. We already know that they have their feud later on. And also, you would have to check in with him because he's not really a part of their team. He's his own entity. So it's different than if one of the disciples had won it. You know what I mean? And then you know exactly where that belt's going is nowhere.
He's a wild card.
Yeah, he's a wild card. The only thing that I'm frustrated about, but that's how this part of the story is supposed to be, is damn it, they have so much power. They're in control of everything. And it really pisses me off as, you know, a fan of the heroes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a much darker place in the temple. So with Mil Muertes looking on, it was time to get to that triple threat match. And I really enjoyed the commentary on this one, too, from Stryker and Vampiro talking about, you know, eventually something's got to give and they're going to piss one another off. And, you know, they're going to start really sort of throwing the big heavy blows. But we got a series of early near falls from everyone that I thought that was kind of fun. And then I believe it was Son of Havoc said something to Ivelisse, and Evie just slapped the crap out of him. And then that's when it really started going. And then it was on, and pretty much, you know, Matt Stryker was proven right. And that's when we got the, well, even salt looks like sugar line, which I greatly appreciated. But one of my main takeaways before the end of this match was how equally over everyone is in that team. You know, oftentimes in a tag team, there'll be one, you know, that's more popular than the other or you know, things like that. But this team, yeah, like, they all are stars on this team. The audience loves them all seemingly equally. So that was pretty cool to see going down. But Ivelisse picked up the win in this. And I remember that. I mean, I think it's a sort of underrated little bit of history making for Lucha Underground that Ivelisse, a woman, wins against her fellow teammates, and she earned a title shot for the heavyweight championship of a major United States promotion. So that's a big deal. So big win for Ivelisse, though it would be short-lived. But before we got to her match with Mil Muertes, we got Black Lotus and who I've written down, Black Lotus and the Douchers get their first little vignette of these three guys looking for an underground fighting.
Yeah, they're just there for a thrill, man. They're there to watch a match. They are completely lost as far as where the temple is, though.
It's so Bordello of Blood, like Tales from the Crypt kind of thing going on. It's absurd. I love it, though. I think it fits so perfectly because it makes sense, again, in the confines of what Lucha Underground is doing. Yeah, it's supposed to be a underground fighting ring. So you would get people coming to, you know, they heard rumors about this thing. You know, hey, we're looking for a place. We're here. It's called the temple. And so we got our first look at, you know, what's going on with that. We do not see Dario yet, but we saw Black Lotus. But that takes us back to the match where Ivelisse is sort of directing traffic with Havoc and Helico, you know, basically, you know, asking them for backup. But then the Disciples of Death, they come out of nowhere. They take out Team Havoc, and they carry them off, which was super creepy.
This is back when the Disciples of Death still kicked ass, too.
Yeah, absolutely. This is them at the height of their powers, quite literally. But I've written down here in my notes is I forgot how evil Mil seemed here and how dominant he just was at this time. I mean, he was such a great omnipotent champion, and I really enjoyed just how they put that character over here. I mean, you know, Evie got her spots in this, but it was pretty much a dominant Mil Muertes victory.
No, and exactly how it should have been. because of how they were booking him. He's borderline invincible. Remember what he did to Puma at the end of season one.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's Prince Puma.
And Ivelisse had just gone through a match, too. So,
which they had pointed out before this match also. So, I mean, yeah, it's a disadvantage for a couple of different reasons. And you have Katrina, who even went into the ring to use the stone's power.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know how you're supposed to beat him in that.
Yeah,
in that environment.
He was unstoppable. And
ask Katrina, he was unstoppable as he ran right into her.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot. That's right. He ended up giving her the Reaper's Trident there when Evie moved out of the way. I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I thought Evie got the right amount of hope spots. I thought commentary sold the match really well with her. And just she, like you said, she plays such a great underdog. So it was, you know, you feel her pain and you really root for her and everything like that. But she did fall victim to the flatliner.
Everyone does.
And the lick of death.
No, dude, it was a dick tease lick of death.
That's right. That's right, because she wanted another flatliner.
Yeah.
And so,
don't do that to me, Katrina. I need to see that lick of death.
So they set up for the other flatliner. And this, I got to say, I love this whole episode. I think is a near perfect episode of Lucha Underground because it showcases all the things about it. Like this, other than missing Mundo and Cage, this has almost all of our favorite performers in it, which I'm getting to in a moment. So Ivelisse is about to eat a second flatliner and who knows how many, but Prince Puma comes to the rescue, like the true hero that he is. I love it. He swoops in there. He hits Mill and literally just sweeps up Ivelisse off her feet to get out of there. And going back through the crowd, and this is one of my all-time favorite Lucha Underground moments, is so Prince Puma does that, and then as Mil Muertes looks on so angry, Pentagon from behind gets Mil with the backstabber and breaks Mil Muertes' arm. Like, I did not see that coming when I was running the whole episode. Like, I was, like, kind of, you know, I was enjoying it, but I was kind of pissed because I was like, dude, where's Pentagon, man? Like, how long do I have to wait for Pentagon? I'm not going to get him in the opening episode. And then there he is, and it really does. This is what sort of cemented the Goku-Vegeta-type dynamic between Prince Puma and Pentagon, in my opinion. Puma saves Ivelisse, and then Pentagon takes out the dominant champion, Mil Muertes, and just the look on Puma's face as he was receding through the crowd looking at Pentagon, it just, even though he's wearing the mask, you could just see the emotion on his face, like the sort of incredulity and just the dynamic sort of shifting here. What did you think about how this ended? Because it's probably my favorite ending in Lucha Underground.
Phenomenal ending. How can you not be excited about the direction season two is going after this? I like it because you were saying Prince Puma, always the hero, comes in, saves the girl. Pentagon Jr. is just there for chaos and to start shit.
burnt the forest down.
Yeah, sees an arm, has no choice but to, and not just any arm, but the arm.
Yeah,
in the temple.
Vampiro
to break.
Looking like, on in
not
kind
a,
of horror.
A more prestigious arm to break. Yeah. Oh yeah, Vampiro. It cuts to Vampiro's face when Pentagon is doing things in these first few episodes is hysterical.
Yeah. It just, oh my God. And then, you know, just with Pentagon's music, like playing throughout the temple as we closed out with the action there, it was tremendous. And I loved going back and rewatching it. Just, it made me feel good. So that was a lot of fun, but we had a postscript vignette, which again, this episode had everything that Lucha Underground can bring to the table, which is the postscript vignette. We got Black Lotus and the Douchers again. And I just, again, I love these noobs looking for the underground fighting at the temple. I think it makes total sense. I love that it's putting over the entire concept of the show in this season two premiere. Black Lotus kicked that one's ass. Dario Cueto was in true Dario Cueto form here. And I don't know. I thought he was counting the money, though. Like, I mean, that's chump change to you, Dario, I hope. But
that's what I was thinking. Well, you know, he's on the run, though. Maybe they really needed that $60.
That's true. You wish he had that suitcase from Johnny Mundo.
Mm-hmm. And how much does it cost to feed Matanza?
Yeah, that is... well,
man's a beast.
Well, apparently costs $60 of those guys' money. So, because, yeah, they enter into what is Dario Cueto's new fighting arena, or so it would appear. And I just love, like, who's fighting tonight? And again, it's true, like, Tales from the Crypt, Are You Afraid of the Dark kind of, you know, like, action. And it's just, you are. And he locks the door, and they, you know, we just hear them get ripped apart off screen. I just, that was great. and setting up more of what would become for Matanza. So overall, your thoughts on A Much Darker Place?
Oh, no, I think it was a great episode. Every match was excellent. I mean, second and third one connect with each other. We saw, like you said, almost every key player that we needed to for season two. The Mil Muertes storyline in the first half of season two, I thought was great. And I really liked how they did it. I also like that the spotlight is on Pentagon Jr. and Prince Puma at the end of this episode. And so you think those are basically our keys for any sort of hope when battling Mil Muertes. But don't forget the guy who lost everything in the first round, because he's going to come back. The first match, he's going to come back, and then he's the one who actually saves the day. It's Phoenix who dethrones Mil Muertes.
Yeah.
And I think it almost has to be, because, like we've talked about, nobody has a better history than Phoenix with Mil Muertes, or maybe a more successful one.
Yeah, no.
Puma's feud is good, too, but...
It's the eternal struggle of life versus death, you know, man of a thousand lives, man of a thousand deaths. It's beautiful.
Eventually
poetry.
Those thousand lives are going to run out, though, James.
Not yet. Not until he comes for Cuerno and for Mil and for you, Katrina. the next episode was the third episode of season two. The Hunt is On. And right off the bat, my very first note, and I know I texted you, I just have written down, egg on my face, because Bengal still did have another match left in Lucha Underground after Ultima Lucha 1.
But I think he died in this match.
I think so, too.
That's how I'm picturing it, story-wise.
Yeah, I think this was his final appearance until I am proven otherwise, but it was Bengala versus the debuting Cobra Moon. We got a little bit of lucha lore being dropped about the Snake Tribe from Vampiro, and just, you know, he was kind of spooked about all that, which I really enjoyed. And Cobra Moon really playing up the whole slithering movements and everything like that. I think it is kind of perfect that they picked these two to fight, because it really was like a snake taking down its prey and, like, eating it, even right down to the finish. Like, the snake sleeper really was, you know, that's what it sort of seemed like to me. What did you think?
When it comes to Cobra Moon, I love how she moves. I love her entire moveset. There are some athletes in Lucha Underground who I really think adopt their characters well as far as how they adapt, how they fight in the ring. But, I mean, she's one of the better ones. Everything she does is very snake-like. She's constantly trying to mimic a slithering-type movement. And just everything she did. And, yeah, how she fought Bengala. I really like this match a lot. And then kudos to her, because, as we know, not a lot of people debut with a victory.
I was thinking about that, too.
So, I mean, yeah, maybe she was more of a force to be reckoned with than we thought. You know, like, going back and looking at this. It was against Bengala. We have to keep that in mind.
Hey, that guy was in the Gift of the Gods match. You know, he had a pendant.
You know what? That's a medallion.
Medallion.
That's true.
Sorry, I got my Legends of the Hidden Temple, my Lucha Underground cross there.
Happens to me all the time.
But, you know, so, you know, don't sleep on Bengala, even though she put him to sleep permanently. I will say this.
No, and then I think she ate him whole.
Yeah, I do too. He looked like, he was like just with his eyes closed in that hole. It just looked like it's like, oh, man, this guy's going to get digested by Cobra Moon.
Yeah.
So that's how we start here with The Hunt is On. And then we get Phoenix and Katrina with Phoenix demanding, you know, he wants his Gift of the Gods championship back. I will say this because I forgot when we were talking about the debut. I love how Katrina's set up in Dario's office, how she has made it her own with the you know, the black magic candles and all the voodoo crap in there and everything like that. The portrait of Katrina in the background, I'm not sure if we see it in this vignette. It might be one with Ivelisse in her office. But did you see that in the background?
No, I did not.
Yeah, there is an absolutely rad, like, old school looking portrait of Katrina in, like, this dress hanging on the wall of the office. And I did not notice it watching season two the first time. But I'm like, holy crap! Like, I would love to have just like a poster of that, you know, hanging in one of the studios here or something like that. I think that's so cool. It's very Dorian Gray-esque, but yeah, just how she has her whole proprietor set up in there is very cool, I thought. But so Phoenix is going at it with Katrina again. That's when he says that, you know, he's not going to run out of lives before he comes for Cuerno, Mil Muertes, and you, Katrina. And so she is nonplussed about that, But that's what did you think of about that vignette, first of all, before we move on to one that I really want to talk about?
Do you think she loves Phoenix?
Yes, but she loves me more. But I think, you know, she
story wise, I think as like far as a brother what she was referring to. Oh,
like, you know, it's like a friend.
Because she had that feeling of, you know, when he came into the office and.
Yeah, the tingle.
Yeah.
I wish she would tell me that.
You know that tingle also, just when you see Katrina.
Yeah, to almost say, excuse myself.
I like the two of them together. I like their chemistry. I like what they say to one another. And then also just, I don't know, it still feels incomplete to me as far as that feud goes. So I wouldn't mind seeing Phoenix back involved in that. I don't know if we ever will.
I think we will.
Storyline-wise, it seems like different things are going on right now, but it would be cool to see.
She is drawn to him for whatever reason that there is that, because I think for her, I mean, what are her goals? Eternal life? Who better than the man of a thousand lives? You know, that would be sort of draw to her, even though it is coming from a very different perspective that she comes from.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. But other than that, yeah, I enjoy their chemistry is good, like you said.
I also, yeah, like you, I like how the office is transformed. I really like how the temple is transformed. It's not fun anymore. There's no live band. It's just creepy, brooding Mil Muertes sitting on a throne. It's very uncomfortable if you were by him. You know, it's like, it really is like a dark, creepy place.
That's a really good point. I didn't even realize that, no live band and everything
it's
like that.
It's not fun, man.
Yeah, it's scary in there. That's
because it's not about entertainment anymore. It really is just about the fighting and power struggle.
Yeah, that's a great, great point. The next vignette we got, because we went vignette to vignette here. And
how awesome is this? I'm loving all the storytelling.
This is one of my favorites in the history of Lucha Underground. This is why Aerostar, one of the reasons why Aerostar is so awesome.
If this was in season one, you'd be an Aerostar boy right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm becoming more and more, as I rewatched, I was like, dude, Aerostar is the shit. He's my kind of guy. We are 1,000 years in the past. And we see an Aztec tribesman talking about the war between the tribes and everything. It's going on, and it's also being narrated by, I believe, a young girl. And that's when Aerostar shows up, you know, talking about that's nothing compared to what's coming, and the tribesmen ask what's coming. He's like, the gods as men on Earth. And he says, well, that's not going to happen for another 1,000 years. And he's like, well, then I will go there. And he shoots up into the sky and time travels. I mean, this is just such an awesome little prequel bit of lore. And how they have to unite the seven tribes, and the girl who's narrating, I don't know if that's Captain Vasquez, or maybe it's even, I more than likely probably a Vasquez, since we know that she is, you know, somewhat aged as well because of the medallion. Well, so I love this vignette and all the lucha lore that we got in it. What did you think?
I love it. It syncs up very well with a Rey Mysterio Jr. vignette that we're going to talk about, because obviously, when they're talking about gods taking the form of man and the seven tribes having to unite against that, I can't help, of course, but think of Cage right now and what's going on with the gauntlet.
Yep.
But Rey Mysterio Jr. and El Dragon Azteca Jr. are talking about something similar. I don't think it's this episode. I think it's another one that we watched. About how Dario's father had sacrificed his son to have a god possess him, basically.
Yeah.
And so we're also talking about Matanza. And Rey's goal is also to find a way to unite the seven tribes. So I'm wondering if El Dragon Azteca Jr. is going to have to lead the seven tribes against either one or both, Matanza and Cage. I still think Cage could just destroy Matanza. Something like that may happen, where Matanza just gets killed.
Yeah, I think
once
that's probably
Cage
coming.
Is completely possessed.
Yeah, it's going to suck for Cage, man.
I'm hoping that they find a way to salvage Cage after they banish the god that's taken him over. I don't know how the story's going to go. What I'm imagining is not necessarily what's going to happen on the show, because I'm imagining huge things.
I am still hopeful more for Cage to, in a match, they do some type of thing where he gets bloodied and it's just like some type of cybernetic like thing underneath his skin. And like we got agents coming into the temple to try and take him back. is a machine.
I love Mundo's description of Cage. I got some idiot who thinks he's a machine.
We'll get there. We will get there. Absolutely. But yeah, that was one of my favorite vignettes ever in Lucha Underground. And again, more vignette heavy stuff, because we jump then to King Cuerno and Katrina, with Katrina being like, hey, dude, you didn't finish the job on Phoenix. He's back asking for more. And we're going
to
do.
He's like, bitch, you told me to get the belt from him. I've got the belt from him.
Yeah,
you told me
you
not
want?
To use the belt. I'm not using the belt.
You make the matches here, you know? So whatever, that's solved. But she's saying that, you know, you got to finish the job. Last luchador standing. I loved this too. Their interactions was great, with it being sort of like this weird intimidation / seduction dance that they were doing. And with when Katrina got in close, telling him to, you know, to finish off Phoenix, or you know what might happen, and just King Cuerno just going the hunt, and then just going and like just taking a huge whiff of Katrina, which I'm very jealous, and saying the hunt is on. I thought that was fantastic, and I just again sort of another precursor to what would become a big feud in season two. What'd you think?
I was thinking of basically the feud that's coming, and it's like, you don't push Cuerno around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you can't ask too much of that guy, because you're going to piss him off, or you're going to start having him look at things differently. It was only a matter of time before he went after Mil Muertes, the more I'm looking at this older stuff. So, yeah, I'm not surprised. But I also thought it was kind of funny to say he was undefeated in this style of matches. He had fought one of these matches before.
Hey, undefeated's undefeated. You know,
like Michael Cole is undefeated at WrestleMania. You're
right. Thank you for that. We then got back to the ring finally with Jack Evans taking on Drago. And this match would have ramifications that I did not appreciate, because I love Drago. And Jack Evans is a great heel, but he is a douche. And
he's such a great douche.
He is. He really is tremendous. One of the things that I wrote down in my notes is that when Matt Stryker mentioned on commentary that it's like they were breakdancing the ring, and just made me think of Zoolander with breakdance fighting.
Breakdance fighting.
Yeah. And just a couple other things I got to point out as far as things that they did in the match. When Evans leapt onto the turnbuckle and did like the peekaboo Ginyu Force thing between his legs, only to have Drago kick the crap out of his face, I thought that was awesome. But, yeah, so Evans got, like, I think sort of a dirty win here. His foot was barely on the ropes, but it was still on the ropes.
I don't even know how much that helps him leverage-wise.
No, and honestly, especially with that kind of pin. So he got,
yeah,
like, that's what
it's
I kind of,
so
like,
incidental.
He did not cheat enough, in my opinion, to beat Drago here. And that's when he jumps on the table and starts calling himself Jack the Dragon Slayer Evans. What did you think?
I love how Jack interacts with the audience. I liked it when we saw him live. And I like him here. I enjoy it when certain members of Lucha Underground use the mic in the ring. I think it's useful. And it's something that we don't always see, because it's more like a regular wrestling promotion at that point. Jack just really feeds off the vibe, and he does a great job of pissing everybody off. He's also just such an arrogant prick, but at the same time, he has such phenomenal athletic ability. How could he not, you know?
Yeah.
And I like the Dragon Slayer title. I think it's great. And
it upsets me.
I wasn't a huge fan of this feud, just because I don't think it really went anywhere.
Yeah.
Honestly, like the nunchuck tag team match or whatever the hell that was. But I still thought this was a good match. I thought it was the feud turns into four very talented athletes.
The
so,
feud
I mean,
is important. Is important in this sense too, because it helps create two very important teams. In that it unites Drago and Aerostar, and eventually Phoenix, into becoming, you know, a future trios champion. And it unites PJ Black and Jack Evans, who would then become, you know, a part of the foundation of the Worldwide Underground. So that is important in that sense. But it upset me again as a mark for wrestling. Like, I love Drago, and I hate that Jack Evans, this tool, got a win over Drago and is calling himself the Dragon Slayer. It's like the total, like, older brother, like, dick move, like, I beat you in a video game, and I'm going to churn it off and say I retire as champion kind of thing.
Like, well, you know what pissed me off was, it's not even like he really kicked Drago's ass, because then Drago's just standing up in the ring and, like, shaking his head no. It's like, no, man, you barely beat me, bro. This doesn't count as a slaying.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just...
Like, you won the match, don't get me wrong, but you did not slay me.
Yeah. But we'll get more of that in these in the episodes to follow.
This goddamn general in the Snake Tribe Army, how dare you?
Yeah, exactly. Show you. We then got
kid?
A Tejano promo. Which, again, a little bit of egg on my face that I guess they did explain away Blue Demon Jr. a little bit here in this.
Were they retired again?
Yeah, they retired back to Mexico and everything like that, and that he's still coming for Chavo and the crew and everything like that. But, you know, it was sort of a lazy explain away still. But at least it was more than I remember them giving us, so there is that. And then, again, very vignette-heavy episode. We got Prince Puma and Katrina interacting. What did you think of this?
When are those two going to just fuck?
Never.
I feel that there's always a tense sexual tension between those two.
I feel like Katrina brings that to most vignettes that she has with people just because.
Yeah, I know. But there's a difference between people wanting to sleep with Katrina and who I feel Katrina wants to sleep with. I think she kind of wants to sleep with Puma and she wants to sleep with Phoenix.
And?
I said all the names.
You're an ass. You're an asshole.
You know what? Maybe if I see a vignette with the two of you together, okay. I'll tell you how much Katrina was picking up what you were dropping.
Thanks. I appreciate it. But what else did you think about it?
I'm trying to think if I wrote anything. Oh, just I like it because you get little contemplative praying Puma, and then you have very sacrilegious and just shitty attitude Katrina coming in. But I mean, I get it. She's a witch. What would I expect her? Of course, she would scoff at whatever religion Puma is a part of.
I liked her talking about how Conan prayed as the life was drained from him in the coffin that was jacked up. That was good. That was good stuff. But then
she's a bad bitch too.
Yeah, she is. She is very much so. Then it comes to the main event, which is the last Luchador standing match: Phoenix versus King Cuerno. What did you think of this? I mean, this was another really enjoyable fight between the two of them, I thought.
It was. I like the concept of this type of match, but I don't exactly enjoy the execution. I don't think it's perfect because I feel it's very inconsistent with the count. And that sort of thing really bothers me. I think sometimes it's a slower count. I think sometimes the count doesn't start right away. I think sometimes the count is stopped prematurely while people are still lying on the ground. I just don't feel like the rules are completely fleshed out the way it's supposed to be for this type of match.
So you take issue with head referee Marty Elias?
I do, yeah, and I that's where I was taken out of this match, basically, was with a lot of that. I do like, because we see this almost all the time, King Cuerno's frustration with what he thinks is a slow count.
Yeah, I like him counting along.
That was great. Yeah, that part was fun, and I mean, he does that all the time. But, I mean, yeah, just sometimes it seems weird. I think it's a great idea for a match because you're basically just pulverizing your opponent. And it gives you the freedom and the opportunity to basically go anywhere and do anything. There's no count out. I mean, you can knock out a guy anywhere. It could be in the ring. It could be outside. I like the way it ended. I remember the ending to this match.
Yep.
And that stood out to me greatly. I forgot that this, though, was... This was not for the title. This was nothing. This was basically just to try to finish off Phoenix, and it went back. It backfired.
It backfired, thus leading to Phoenix earning, because of how it ended with Cuerno getting kicked off the ladder. So it would end in a ladder match for the Gift of the Gods championship.
Ah, I see.
Yeah. And there's some great spots in this, though, that I thought was really fun. They have really good chemistry. Like Phoenix corkscrewing out into the crowd onto Cuerno was just awesome. But yeah, great finish. Really fun match. I get what you're saying, but I also like just the little twist that Lucha Underground puts on things. Like, instead of just being a last man standing match, it's a last luchador standing match. So it's great. We then end the episode with a police station vignette. I believe this is our first trip into the police station, if I'm not mistaken, to realize that that Cortez is a police officer.
Dude, this is the scene that salvaged Cortez Castro's character, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, so
I completely turned around on the guy when I saw this.
So it's revealed that he's an undercover cop, and he's explaining about how he's in tight with Chavo Guerrero and the crew and everything. I like how dismissive Vasquez is of the crew. It's like, yeah, you're telling us. But and then this is the debut of Officer Joey Ryan. And just all smiles from here that Joey Ryan would be joining the temple.
Joey Ryan is such a prick. I really like him, but man, he's such an annoying bastard. What I liked about this was the last shot where it cuts to a close-up of Joey Ryan, and if you look in his sunglasses, it's just Vasquez's finger pointing at Dario's picture. Yeah. That their only purpose is to get Dario Cueto.
Yep.
Which I was thinking about it. This storyline is one of my favorites too, because it's so like any type of cop movie.
Yeah.
It reminds me of like The Departed or anything like that. Cause Cortez Castro really is just kind of left out to screw several times.
Yep.
And then like he was saying, he's like, I told everybody to move in on Dario after he killed Bale. And then, and it's like, of course they would say the murder of some random hoodlum doesn't matter, that we're trying to bust him for something bigger. And it's like, yeah, Castro would just still be stuck there in this incredibly dangerous situation. And now he's got Joey Ryan, who it's a guy watching his back, but at the same time, that's not who you want watching your back in the temple.
Yeah.
At which we really find out.
I think he's going to be true blue in the end. I still got faith in him.
Well, I think something really bad is going to happen.
Yeah, Joey Ryan is going to probably get murdered by God Cage. So that's probably coming. But the other thing about this with Captain Vasquez too, and why she wouldn't want to move in on Dario Cueto, is because she, as we would find out in season 3, is the holder of at least half of this ancient Aztec medallion that grants eternal life. And so she knows about this whole war with the gods and everything like that and the Aztec tribes. So she's playing an even bigger game than just the police force here, you know?
That's true. I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
Yeah, she's playing a long con. I just hope it's not too long. Before we get into the final two episodes of this week's Greatest Hits that we are going to recap here for you all, I want to take this little time, do a little commercial break, which is to thank you, all the believers that listen to the podcast. We love interacting with you, and the fact that you're enjoying the show makes us feel really good. If you could rate and review us on iTunes, subscribe to us if you have not already, and for some reason you're just listening to this on Audio Boom or any of the other venues that you can catch us, subscribe to us on Audio Boom on iTunes, rate and review us, share with your friends. Word of mouth is the best way to get the word out about this podcast. And hit us up on social media. Follow us on Twitter at Lucha Lowdown. You can like us on Facebook as well. We're not hard to find. And if you want to personally email us any questions, comments about the show, luchalowdown@gmail.com. We really appreciate it. Love all you believers. And thank you all for the support. Appreciate you. Moving on now to the third episode of 4 Greatest Hits in this marathon. Greatest Hits of Lucha Underground, as we kicked off going back through season 2. Is the episode titled Cerro Miedo, which, of course, when it aired live, got me very excited for the prospects of my favorite luchador in the temple, Pentagon Jr. This one, it's you know, setting up everything, very much so Pentagon's rise. You know, I think at this point, he had tried to break Puma's arm, I believe, in the previous week, and that was all for naught. Set up a match between them, which is the main event is Prince Puma versus Pentagon Jr. And I remember when they were promoting this, it just felt like such a huge deal for Pentagon in particular, you know, that he was going to be going up against Prince Puma. Like, this was a very much so it's like, yes, this is an arrival moment kind of deal. Do you remember that when they were first promoting it and just sort of that whole vibe surrounding Pentagon and his sort of ascension?
Well, Pentagon had definitely, like, I don't know when it happened exactly, but he jumped to basically that top tier status where he was just one of the faces to watch. Honestly, I think it happened just at the end of that first episode where then he comes in and breaks Mil Mortez's arm. Because before that, his feud was, I mean, other than just against Sexy Star, I mean, it was against more like B-level guys.
Yeah, I think.
Even a match against Vampiro, that's like a specialty match, you know, that's not one of the main, like, stories or anything like that.
I do think that the attention that story had, though, put him on the map as one of the top-tier guys.
Oh, well, no, because he got a pop from the audience as far as reactions go. So I think, I mean, that's what helped showcase him. But as far as taking him seriously.
Yeah.
And him being, or him interacting with all of the major players, it was that he just hit the scene. I mean, you could tell by the way the audience reacted when he came into the ring after Puma had saved Ivelisse. I mean, the temple went nuts.
Yeah.
You know, and he was kind of milking it for a little bit. You know, he's standing there, he's looking around, and then, he grabs the arm and breaks it. I mean, I thought that was just a great season 2 debut for him, and I think that's what really set the tone for, well, I guess really how the rest of his temple career has gone so far, because he's never stepped down or anything like that. He still very much is a major player.
Yeah, he's one of the most popular, if not the most popular luchador in the temple.
I don't know if we could say anybody's the most popular because Prince Puma is so amazing, James. But yeah, he definitely is one of the most popular.
I think we could probably say Pentagon's probably.
I think we could probably say Prince Puma still, you know, because I mean the guy carried the temple on his back, especially in season one.
He definitely had a great title run, but I think Pentagon's probably the most popular since I think he even threatened his own mother and the crowd still popped. So
beat the crap out of several women in a row. Yeah. And the audience demanded more.
Yeah, so he's pretty much the Teflon Don as far as luchadors go.
He's definitely in that second group, like with Phoenix and everybody like that. You know, there's Prince Puma. He's like a step or two above.
No, he is in a pantheon, probably occupied only maybe with Rey Mysterio as well. They even cheered him to break Rey Mysterio's arm. So, you know.
That was weird.
So, you know, there's that. I saw Penta and Cody Rhodes go at it at APW up here in San Francisco. And I love Cody Rhodes. I adore Cody Rhodes. I consider Cody a friend. But I was chanting with the audience to break his arm too. So, you know, it's just he casts a spell on the audience. It's Penta, man. It's great.
Pentamodium.
That's not too bad. It was great too seeing that, you know, Cody, because now he's joined the Bullet Club in Japan and ROH just throwing up the too sweet symbol with the crowd cheering, and then like. Penta just quieting the crowd, and they'd throw up the Cerro Miedo and see how that did too. It was awesome, but I digress. We started Cerro Miedo with Ivelisse in Katrina's office, and this is where you see that portrait of her that I was talking about, and basically that she had she wanted her rematch for the Trios Championships, and Katrina was just like, well, you know, it's not guaranteed under my leadership.
God bless her, man. I wanted to kiss Katrina on the mouth right then. I love the idea of. I love the idea of no automatic rematch clauses. I hate the rematch clause.
Well, her temple is your kind of thing.
Exactly. But I really enjoyed the first part of season two, so that doesn't surprise me.
I enjoyed all of it. Team Havoc, though, would be in action, and that is what we got next. And I got to call shenanigans on Matt Stryker on commentary. I don't know if you noticed this, but as the crew was making their way out there, Matt Stryker's like, and I think the most dangerous one, the one you got to really look at, is the most dangerous in this crew is Mr. Cisco. And I'm just like, what? Mr. Cisco is the most dangerous?
Yeah, Mr. Cisco is clearly the weakest of the group. But then he called him the most dangerous again during the match. I don't know if that's supposed to be his nickname. But what I was thinking was funny was Matt was saying that, you know, Cisco first just came to the temple looking for a place to sleep.
Yes.
And I was like... You'll get this, James. Thank you, Ronald Reagan. Your legacy is intact.
Your legacy is intact, yeah.
Because you were talking about how Cisco, you almost felt bad for him.
Yeah.
Because he clearly is just a thug. He's in over his head. He's helped kill a man by holding him against the bars and having this monster tear him apart. It turns out he's just a homeless man. Looking for some food and a warm place to sleep.
Yeah, just need a place to lie his head.
Way out of control.
Yeah. I mean, maybe things are looking up for him here. You know, yeah, he had to kill a guy, but now he's working with a lucha legend like Chavo. I did like on commentary.
He did get to wear a suit also at the end of the season.
Yeah, it's true. I like them pointing out that Chavo's like afraid to be on his own, you know, and that's why he sort of hitched his wagon to the crew and everything, that he needs their help. I thought that was great sort of selling just how seedy and what a scumbag Chavo Guerrero is.
Well, that's true, but I was thinking of it as Chavo just inherited the crew. The crew are like those two henchmen bullies from Boy Meets World, and Chavo's Griff, and now they're with him now.
Yeah,
because Dario moved away. So they need a new bully.
Yeah, or if you want to make another reference, it's like in Mean Girls when Regina left the plastics for that time, and it just Gretchen and Karen attached themselves to Caddy. You know, for all those Mean Girls fans out there. Listen to the podcast. I know you're out there. Don't leave me out. You should love that movie, Jeff. It's a great movie.
Not going to sell for you.
but we do get Team Havoc versus Chavo's crew. Just some of the things I have written down as far as notes go is I love how popular Team Havoc is again. I mean, just when you see it in the great hot tags and just some of the moves that they do, just the crowd popping. The high flying and stereo, and Helico was really laying in some great shots. Like he hit a flying knee that just looked incredible. And so, I mean, they got the much deserved win. I don't think anybody thought that was in doubt. And it was enjoyable for what it was. What'd you think?
My favorite part was the very end where they basically all dive off of the apron, or I think Angelico is actually in the ring and he goes over the ropes. They all do it in sync. And I thought it was very well done. And I was just, I couldn't help but think of where the team had been at the beginning of season one, where, you know, they were rivals and that they didn't like each other, and then how they were forced to be a team, and it was almost a joke on Dario's part to even put them together. And now they really are in sync, and they seem to care about each other story-wise, and I love it. Like I said, these are some of my favorite characters to watch on the show, because I feel that they actually progress, because I think their characters complement each other so well, and their matches are some of the most fun to watch.
They gotta put them back together.
Like, I feel really bad for them, because one or two of them is always getting hurt recently, you know, and it's just unfortunate luck.
Yeah. I also heard a rumor that Havoc got hurt in an indie show recently, too.
Oh, boy. So now, see, he was the sturdiest one, yeah. And now him, too. And not for lack of doing wild stuff. All three of them have great spots, but he just happened to be the fortunate one.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, boy, man. Star-crossed.
Not good. But what a great team. Yeah, I just want to see them all back together doing their thing. They're awesome. All right. From there, we got a great, great...
Well, I was going to say Tejano comes in.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So Tejano, yeah, that's right, because I have written down here. I guess we did get
Lucha
a follow-up.
Underground, this does not count as Tejano returning to the temple of him just coming in and beating the crap out of guys.
According to them, no.
That's bullshit.
Although
there's a long pattern of Tejano being disrespected on Lucha Underground as far as his booking goes.
I liked Tejano, yeah, and I almost disrespected him by moving right along. But yeah, I forgot that he came in and attacked Chavo and the crew and everything like that. They actually had
and
the
barely
guy,
got Chavo.
Yeah, he did have that cool moment, like biting like the rope and everything like that was cool.
Dude, he's another one. I'm gonna bring this up when we're talking about somebody else too. Another one who's just disrespecting Mil. I can't believe how many people were calling out Mil Muertes in this, because he was staring right at him and biting the rope.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, Mil doesn't trifle with him. But from there, we got what I think probably is one of your favorite moments from this week's greatest hits, which is we got a Johnny Mundo segment here. Mundo facts and talking about that big, dumb, idiot Cage, and even dropped an obsolete, too, in there. I don't know if you caught that, but what did you think about this?
I did not catch the obsolete. I should watch that again. I liked it. It was Johnny Mundo just working out and talking about himself.
Yeah.
I feel you, Johnny. We've all been there.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just love some big dumb idiot that thinks he's a machine. What a great line.
And just the recap stuff too, showing his interactions with Cage was awesome, and how he interrupted Cage's catchphrase. And yeah, like you said, working out in his dojo, just so very Johnny Cage, which is funny that he's feuding with Cage and he's Johnny Mundo.
Hey man, this is Johnny's world. Everyone else is just living in it.
It was a great segment, and it just Mundo is awesome, and that was a really awesome vignette. And then from there, we got Joey Ryan and Cortez in the locker room, and I gotta agree with Cortez here when Joey just rolls in and starts talking about their undercover police work, and he's like, you know,
dude,
come on, we're in a locker room, bro.
This conversation is too personal, and this is an incredibly public place. You got to shut the fuck up, man. Have you even been an undercover cop before?
Yeah.
Anybody could be in that locker room. Hell, Katrina just teleports in and out constantly.
Yeah, she casts Blink. So I'm with Cortez on that. And then, but we do, that does lead to Joey Ryan's debut match at Lucha Underground. And I actually forgot who he was facing here. And so it's because see Joey Ryan coming out, and then from the 559, and my first note written down here is Joey Ryan is dead because Cage is coming out, and we'll circle back to that in a minute. But I don't know what Matt Stryker was doing on commentary in this one, as far as just I think heavy sarcasm, but was just talking about how he's just like a normal guy. And everything like
what
that.
What the hell was he talking about, man?
I think he was trying to be super sarcastic in comparison to Joey Ryan, because Cage is clearly like just this, you know, super fit. You know, he's a machine.
No, but then he was saying the no tattoos and stuff like that. I thought what he was originally trying to say was that Cage was more like an older style type wrestler. Because one thing I love about Cage is just his build and his physique. I miss wrestlers looking like that.
Yeah.
Or at least a certain percentage of them. Because it makes him larger than life. If you saw Brian Cage, you know, like in an airport or something, you'd flip out. I remember when I saw Lex Luger in a hotel one time.
Lex Express.
It blew my effing mind how big that guy was.
No, I feel you on that.
But yeah, so that's what I thought he was trying to say. Because when he was talking about tattoos, he wasn't, like he even said, he wasn't talking about like Vampiro's tattoos. He was talking about like modern day tatted up dudes. And that's like phony and lame. And then... I forget. He said something about beards and stuff. I don't know if he was talking about hipsters and that Cage is not a hipster.
I think maybe. I think that's.
But like, I don't think hipsters fight in the temple though either. Because all right, which wrestler is a hipster? Then?
I think Joey Ryan might be a little hipster.
No, Joey Ryan. It reminds me of the characters from Vampiro's uncle's videos from the 70s.
Yes, don't say anymore. that is Joey Ryan's whole gimmick, but. Cage hit the screwdriver and immediately Matt Stryker just said, Joey Ryan's dead. And I just like referred back to my notes. I was like, huh, I was correct. Joey Ryan is dead. But then
Are you as surprised as I, though, how long Joey Ryan stood his ground and held his own?
Matt Stryker and Vampiro certainly were surprised about it. Yeah, I did not think it. I remember I did not remember him holding his own like that with Cage.
I forgot that the two of them had ever even fought one-on-one before. So good on Joey for that. Also, I was surprised how many strong Joey chants we had right before the match started, too. I was happy that his character was already somewhat over. I mean, I know people already knew who Joey Ryan was, but I mean, against someone as popular as Cage in the Temple, I mean, I thought that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I think that's awesome, too. And one thing I will say from, you know, talking to Joey at independent shows, he is a really personable guy and treats the fans really well. So he's a good dude. But Johnny Mundo attacked post-match, setting up more of that great feud of Mundo versus Cage. But from there...
Dude, wait, no, my favorite part was him going, welcome to Slamtown, bitch.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That? Yeah, that's right, yeah.
That was great.
I did like that, too. From there, we did get a vignette with Azteca Jr. and Mysterio, and we got some Azteca lore, some Cueto lore, old Aztec gods. What did you think about everything that was being dropped in this?
This is the vignette I was referencing when we were talking about Aerostar. I really like this one. One thing I love, though, is Rey going, don't go looking for revenge. And then next scene would be Azteca looking for revenge. That's all Azteca is doing is
looking
for revenge.
Kid doesn't listen.
No.
You know, he's young. He's impetuous. You know, he can't stop him.
It's kind of exciting seeing Azteca Jr. at this stage of the game because you know that he's destined for greatness. And you know that, like, if this was a book series or something, you would read one later and he'd be much older and, like, much more controlled and, you know, just, like, well-rounded fighter. But at this point, he's just impetuous and
he's like Lion-O.
Kind of has a crappy attitude. Wait, what?
He's like Lion-O.
He is like Lion-O. That's a good description of him, too. I still think he's like Anakin, except for he's not going to fall to the dark side.
We hope.
I don't think the tribes will recover if that happens.
Yeah. But no, I enjoyed this. I enjoyed this vignette too. Just the dropping the knowledge of Dario Cueto's dad and his pact with Azteca Senior, and essentially sacrificing his own son Matanza to the Aztec gods was freaking insane. I just all this backstory and stuff and how it ties into Rey and Azteca and everything is just awesome. So I can't wait. We want Lucha Underground to go on forever. But it having the benefit that it is a TV show, if it comes time that they have to end it, at least we know that they have a badass endpoint in mind, like this crazy war and the uniting of the seven tribes. That's pretty rad. So it's awesome to see where this storyline goes. But that did bring us to the main event, which was Prince Puma versus Pentagon Jr. Great stuff from both these guys in this match, I thought. I mean, they had the great sort of like parry and joust to start the match as they were sort of just countering one another. And they did a lot of cool spots in this match. It had a really big match feel to it, which I appreciated. It felt important. And I remember watching it live and not knowing who won and everything like that. Just, you know, on the edge of my seat. What did you think of it?
I'll get to the ending of the match in a second. A couple things that I really liked was the split crowd chant right at the beginning.
Yep.
And then a quote that I absolutely adore is just, I can't think of a better home than the temple for Prince Puma. And I cannot stress that enough.
Same.
I really would like Prince Puma to be here indefinitely.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, just great back and forth between them. I thought they sold it well on commentary, too, that, like, you know, Prince Puma had learned from all of his experiences in season one that he was very much so, you know, a more seasoned Prince Puma now. And Pentagon was sort of more in the role that Puma once had. And Vampiro sort of frustratingly, like, getting upset that Pentagon was paying so much attention to the crowd love that he was getting because he was getting so much of it. I mean, like, the most of it. And then just
I don't know. That's unsubstantiated.
I just wanted to needle you a little bit there, buddy. We're going to be doing this forever, I hope. But as far as the finish goes, I thought it was a good finish because I thought it protected both men in the match, because I thought they should have done the double pin draw finish personally. They did it where Puma got one shoulder up and Pentagon did not. And so Pentagon thought he won. So it was not like where he was beat down and lost. It was sort of one of those technicality things. I thought they protected both guys well there. It was Puma's smarts that won out in the end. What did you think about it?
I was going to say exactly what you just did. It was a technicality. It wasn't that any man was defeated. One of them was just beaten according to the rules. I rewound it because I didn't exactly understand what the hell had happened. I knew that Puma had gotten his shoulders up. I didn't realize that Pentagon's shoulders were down, and I wasn't really listening to the commentary at the time. I thought it was perfect that way. I didn't want to see a draw just because I feel like I don't really like draws in matches. I would rather one person win one way or the other. What I liked about this was if Puma is the more seasoned wrestler at this point and has learned so much from both his experiences and his time with Conan, he would be able to pull a maneuver like that.
Yeah. No, it makes sense.
Yeah. And Pentagon, there's no way for Pentagon to know that Puma's shoulders were up at the last second. You can't feel that from the position that he was in.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
So I can understand. And I liked Pentagon's reaction because I thought that was appropriate for his character, too. At first, you know, he's celebrating as you would think he would. And then when he finds out what happened, he is not pleased.
Yeah, and he had some post-match shenanigans there.
Yeah.
Setting up a little sort of mini Pentagon and Puma feud.
And then almost a taste of his own medicine, which I loved.
Yeah.
Almost. And one of those Mil Muertes reactions like you were talking about.
Yeah, I always like those.
He's very intrigued with that.
Yes, this pleases Mil. Yeah. But that brings
well,
us...
Well, then Puma's like, well, then I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm a good
Katrina
guy.
Katrina did not lick Ivelisse's face.
Yeah. I was in my mind it happened, though. I think I was getting it crossed with Ultima Lucha. We also got the vignette of Sexy Star running away from, you know, didn't know at this point. We thought maybe just Marty, but she bumps into the Mac and she, you know, says, no, not him, her. And then we just look off into the distance and that's how it ends. Time is running short, but we do have one episode to get to here, and that is Death Comes in Threes. It was a really fun episode. Great opening video package that set up everything. We got that Mac and Sexy Star vignette in the early going there that played off of what we saw at the end of Cerro Miedo. And it's going to be Marty the Moth versus the Mac. We get Marty the Moth behind Melissa Santos here doing one of his patented, just, you know, flapping the wings. And Melissa Santos doing her best to keep a straight face here. But I love just all of their many interactions that they've had with the entrances. And it was good going back to this and getting a reminder of that. I thought that was a lot of fun. What is your favorite sort of Marty interaction with Melissa?
Oh, my favorite is without a doubt his face flying into her lap when he goes out of the ring. Now, I think they've done it twice.
Yeah, they've done it at Ultima Lucha most recently that we've talked about.
Yeah, and I know that wasn't the only time. I like it because not only is that hilarious, but her reaction with the scream is just perfect. Like the pitch and everything and how loud it I just can't think of a funnier way for it to go. And I remember when I first saw him do that, I was just like, how effing perfect is it that Marty would do that? That's where he would land. And then, yeah, I really like Melissa's interactions with him.
See, my favorite is still always with the entrance and everything like that. But the notable thing from this match is that during it, the lights go out, the music, the creepy music starts, and we get the debut of Mariposa. And great job by Sexy Star, who was in Mac's corner, of just selling the fear and everything that was going on. I mean, what did you think about when Mariposa first showed up?
Mariposa's debut kind of reminded me of Mankind, and I think it's because of the mask. It is creepy. You know, it's a creepy look. I mean, I've become a bigger fan of Mariposa because I like seeing her in, like, street clothes, that sort of thing. And I've been won over by the pigtails. But, yeah, she's really creepy, and your imagination is kind of left to fill in the blanks as far as what the hell did Mariposa and Marty do to her during the time off between season 1 and season 2. You just know it was not good.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, and as far as how probably like curtailed they were from getting into that on TV, you know. But it is a very
cool. But it's almost kind of better that way.
Yeah, absolutely, because you know? Your mind will go to the dark places in the corners of your own head as opposed to the writers, you know. So it's.
Ooh, I'd hate to think of what Vampiro imagined.
Yeah, well, it's vampire cults mostly.
In Europe.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so that was Mary Poe's debut. We got Marty on the mic a little bit from there. We got a Phoenix vignette, which I really appreciate. It's just one of those sort of promo ones, similar to the Tejano thing, but Phoenix talking about how, like, you know, how he's been defying expectations, and there, you know, nobody's ever believed in him, and that, you know, his whole idea of him being a champion would have been just a myth. And he's like, some myths are worth believing in. It was a really great, like, pro babyface Phoenix promo here for him, and as far as what would be coming for him in season two and everything like that. But from there, we did get a vignette in the ever-popular Lucha Underground bathroom with Jack Evans leaving the pisser, not washing his hands, bumping into Drago, yellow carding it. Drago, none too pleased that Evans is calling himself the Dragon Slayer, and Evans's reaction where he just goes...
Well, it makes sense.
Evans, though, Drago's just going, the people named me that. Even though clearly it was himself that named him that. But this is the infamous the nunchuck battle in the bathroom where it's Evans and Drago, and then PJ Black shows up with the nunchucks, gives a pair to Evans. Drago has his own. So they're all starting to go at it here. And then, Jeff, if you recall, Aerostar lights go out, and then it's Aerostar with his own light-up nunchucks. What are your thoughts on from what you remember of this?
The bathroom sees a lot of action, especially with Aerostar. And, Drago wasn't in that fight with the Snake Tribe. So, yeah, Aerostar's getting into fights in the bathroom left and right. Nunchuck battle, I think it sounds better on paper than what it looks like in reality. You tell me a four-way nunchuck battle and you tell me which characters are involved. I mean, it sounds terrific. But I don't know. It almost is a little goofy.
I don't know. I dug it. And again, it's more.
But you did.
It's more.
Slurp that Drago storyline.
I do. And it's uniting of Drago and Aerostar more. Yeah. So I enjoyed it.
Well, they were already friends, though. I mean, they shook hands at the end of season one.
They were, but.
They did have a tight camaraderie where, you know, one will come and help the other when necessary.
But
and I mean,
this...
I guess they must have known each other 1,000 years ago, too.
Yeah.
When Drago had that other job.
Yeah. And probably was probably not that close with Aerostar, or maybe Aerostar helped break him out of the thrall of it then. I don't know. I guess we'll have to find out. But this is the other side of that coin as far as this more solidifies Drago and Aerostar, but it also solidified PJ Black and Jack Evans as helping out. This is the first time that had really happened in setting up that feud. I just thought Aerostar was so badass in this. It was great. And that
Aerostar is badass. You should have been backing him from day one.
I did back him. It's just I was a Drago guy. Now, you know, who knows? But then where it took us next was Cage versus Johnny Mundo, or so it would appear, because Taya subbed herself in to this match. And I believe this was Taya's debut match.
It was.
And first of all, I liked so much of what, you know, just Taya's whole attitude and everything like that. I think she's awesome. And I think... You know, rightfully so, though, wondering how she would do against a monster like Cage. I mean, we see him. Cage did this, like, this pump slam to her where he had her in, the fall-away slam position. He just started, like, deadlifting her like she was, like a pair of barbells. And that was great. He was, he was just thrown around, like, when he powerbombed her into the wall and then the post. Just, It was an interesting match in that sense because it was definitely vicious, but it was also like compromising positions for Taya. But I think what stands out and I will always remember from this match, and maybe you as well, is Mundo, because it's no DQ. So Mundo came in and attacked Cage with beer bottles, tried to use the cinder block and failed. He had the lead pipe. But what I think will stand out to this is when Cage is no-selling the beer bottles, just the look of horror on Mundo's face and then shoving Taya to Cage, like, it's sacrificing who would become his girlfriend to Brian Cage. What did you think about that?
It is kind of a strange foundation for their relationship, because Taya's still very much new on the scene at this point, and yeah, Mundo has already kind of let her know where the hierarchy is, that, you know, everything to just watch my back. And I mean, she's absolutely loyal to him still to this day. So I think that's kind of funny. I liked Cage and Mundo against each other also. I thought this was a fun feud, as opposed to some of the other storylines where it almost seems like the entire world is at stake. This is really just more about egos and a couple of just old school wrestlers wanting to fight each other.
Yeah.
And I think you need that in the show too. It helps, you know, ease some of the tension with, like I said, with some of the more dire storylines going on.
I agree. And it is from there that we got perhaps the most famous B commercial of all time. It is him with Ugly Brenda. And then, as he says in it, hot damn Alakazam turns her into the beautiful Brenda. I love the famous B ads, and I just think his character has grown and come such a long way, and it's fun going back and watching the old famous B commercials. They're very enjoyable. I love famous B. Like you said, he's one of the true heels too that Lucha has.
And also, I mean, I still feel it's become a lost art form as far as having the great managers, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that used to just be such a staple of professional wrestling. And I mean, it's almost completely gone. I like having characters like this. I think it's important. It helps get more talent out there. I'd much rather see Famous B doing things that I think he's really good at, which is being on the mic, which is being a heel who then sells certain moves, as opposed to just being, you know, just another random fighter that they have. I mean, him in season one almost feels like a waste, you know?
Yeah.
The biggest thing he contributed was having his arm broken for Pentagon.
Yeah, very true. That is very true. Yeah. From there, we did get a Team Havoc vignette where it was going to be win or hit the open road in their title rematch, as far as that goes. But then it was time for the main event. Prince Puma, Pentagon Jr., Mil Muertes, triple threat for the Lucha Underground Championship. This is one of the standout matches from season two, in my opinion. It was a fantastic main event. And just, again, dominant Mil Muertes at this point in time, too. Like, he still very much so is at the height of his powers. And there are some great spots in this. But my why I love Lucha moment, as far as in-the-ring moves, is the series of super kicks that Prince Puma and Pentagon unleashed upon Mil Muertes. It was, I hope he does not have the CTE after that, because those things were vicious. They were each hitting with one, sort of ping-ponging him around, and then they hit the one in stereo. That is an awesome visual still to go back and watch. But Jeff, as we all remember, it is the double flatliner that ended this. What did you think about the triple threat match? It's another one of those things. It was like big fight feel in Lucha Underground.
Yeah, there were a lot of big matches early on in this season, which is great. Like you said, the way they were selling Mil Muertes at this point was this just unstoppable force. Not that he wasn't fearsome in season one, but at least he was still a regular opponent. I mean, hell, Phoenix defeated him once, you know? Or maybe even more than once, I forget now. But, I mean, like, you could have a one-on-one match with him, and it didn't seem like he was so imposing. Now you have Prince Puma, who's definitely one of the top talents of the temple.
Then
and you
have Pentagon,
who is Jr.
assuredly one of the top talents, yeah.
No, but I mean, yeah, these are two of the bigger, you know, characters in the show right now, and it takes both of them, and they still don't get the job done.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty ridiculous. I mean, I don't know who's supposed to go against Mil Muertes next after something like that. Cage, perhaps? He's not a man, he's a machine.
Perhaps the man of a thousand lives, big dumb idiot that thinks he's a machine, Jeff.
Yeah, I think you need someone who has a thousand lives, because that was only two lives against Mil Muertes.
Yes.
And they did not fare so well.
Yeah, you need a lot more than that.
You need 998 more.
Yeah. Well, with that is going to do it for this week's edition of the Lucha Underground Greatest Hits. Four episodes to go through. Woo! We will be back with more next week for y'all. But until then, for Jeff Budd, I'm James Kincaid. Good night, everybody.